Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Paul Eli about his new book, The Last Supper: Art, Faith, Sex, and Controversy in the 1980s. Eli is the author of The Life You Save May Be Your Own, An American Pilgrimage, a group biography of Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton, Flannery O'Connor, and Walker Percy. He followed that up with Reinventing Bach, The Search for Transcendence in Sound, and both books were National Book Critics Circle Award finalists. Paul is a regular contributor to The New Yorker and a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Today, we're talking with him about his impressive and fascinating new work of cultural history, The Last Supper: Art, Faith, Sex, and Controversy in the 1980s. Paul, welcome. It's so good to speak with you.
Oh, I'm so glad to be in conversation with you, Susan.
Now, this is such a grand book in scope, and yet it's so wonderfully detailed. And in it, you're telling the story of what you call crypto-religious art, which is a term you took from the Polish Nobel laureate, Czesław Miłosz. So would you explain crypto-religious for us?
And that's right. I took the term from Miłosz, who used it in his correspondence with Thomas Merton in the 1950s. It figures into my first book, The Life You Save May Be Your Own. Then it was kind of neat to have it be a skeleton key that unlocked the 80s for me in the new book. Crypto-religious art, and this is my definition, not Miłosz, is art, and I mean, you know, literature, music, film, photography, visual art, poetry, that makes use of religious motifs and themes and images and patterns that in a way set apart from conventional belief. So as you're encountering the work, a painting, a photograph, a movie, a record, you're thinking to yourself, wow, does the person who made this, what do they believe? Do they believe on that the song of the prayer or that angels are really significant figures or whatever? And then that question you to think, well, what do I believe? The whole encounter with the work that's cryptic in its religiosity forces the complex and difficult this section that we have, you know, with ourselves but with other people about what religion is and what we are called to believe.
And what are our personal spiritual experiences and quests as well, I think.
Absolutely. And experience is the key word because the point that I'm writing about in the 80s, experience of a lot of people who raised religious, more fluent in religious motifs, had gone out ahead of where a lot of official church figures were willing to go. And so the artist would go where the clerics wouldn't. And in many respects, that's the story of the book because it often led to controversy.
Well, this is a wonderful group portrait again. And so I'm curious, there's so many people in this book. And I'm curious about how the anchor figures came to you and revealed themselves.
Well, first of all, I figured out to focus on the 80s. And as I worked, I gained a sense of the 80s as extending from 1979 to 1992. Let's call it the long 80s. Mm-hmm. 79. Hostages were taken by Islamic fundamentalists in Iran. The moral majority emerged. And Bob Dylan raised Jewish, total independent rebel spirit, went in for evangelical Christianity. So something different was going on. I focused on so much of the art that I'd come of age with in that decade. People who were obvious to me, like U2, whom I saw in 83, Martin Scorsese, I remember walking past the Last Temptation of Christ protest on my way, on my lunch hour, my first job in Midtown Manhattan in 1988, So those figures and Madonna and Prince and Toni Morrison, they're all canonical. But then there were lots of other figures that, as I dug in, I realized were really vital to the story. Leonard Cohen, for example, and Tom Waits, and the Neville Brothers.
And I love Salman Rushdie being included, and I love the Andy Warhol passages. I especially loved Andy Warhol meeting Pope John Paul II. That image of him standing there going, and I always get so nervous in church. I mean, I thought that
was just so much.
And here is a figure, Warhol, not thought to be reverent in any way, but he has a certain vestigial reverence for one that he had, but doesn't stare the people. And there it is, the day he meets John Paul. He's getting nervous in church, even though he's standing at St. Peter's Square with the camera around his neck. This is like the few most famous people of public extraction in the world, and two people who are masters of public image. And there's the Vatican print photo that captures the embrace, and it's a very powerful moment. And I'd be nuts not to begin the book with that, I think.
Oh, it was fantastic. And I went out and rented The Last Temptation of Christ again because I'd forgotten. I hadn't seen it in so long, and I'd forgotten how shocking it was, you know, in its time.
Well, we were kept from seeing it.
Yeah.
After a premiere of a couple of weeks in seven cities, the larger release was shut down by the fear of controversy, and the VHS release was delayed. And so by the time it actually came onto the market, not only the furor had passed, but many of us who were the likely audience of the film hadn't gotten to see it. I watched it myself on DVD, and I got the ability to slow it down and think in what's in the jewelry film.
Was it pretty much as you remembered? I mean, how many times did you have to watch it to write about it in such detail?
Several times.
Yeah.
And with great pleasure, you know.
Uh-huh.
I think what I was struck by is that how much is in it. 95% of the film is drawn straight from the Gospels, and it covers a great deal of material. No, it's thought to be a long film, but we're used to people binge-watching 10 hours of drama at once. 2 hours with some minutes doesn't seem all that long. And there's the whole story of Fees and public ministry, and then a whole fantasia or dream sequence involving Galat temptation, which is to come down from the cross, make a family with Mary Magdalene, and live out that life.
It was amazing. What I took away from it also was that I would have lasted about 15 minutes in that landscape. I mean, it was just so barren and inhospitable. I mean, oh. So anyway.
The ability to capture the toughness of life and the everyday violence of life, certainly something that he brought to the movie.
I want you to talk about the cover image, which is so arresting.
In New York at that time, the Archbishop of New York, John Cardinal O'Connor, used the cathedral as a bully pulpit to speak really vigorously about the traditional church teaching, especially about sex and sexuality. This is what he'd been put there to do by John Paul II in his own account. He would do press conferences after Mass. He would invariably make the next case, tabloid papers. He drew a lot of attention. And when he forced a group of gay Catholics to cease worshiping at a Jesuit church downtown, they were upset. They were peaceful masses, community that was, as I said, ravaged by AIDS. People were really suffering. And now they've been out that they can't even worship together in the Catholic Church. So on the first anniversary of the outbreak, members of this group, which was called Dignity, formed a human cross outside St. Patrick's Cathedral. And that's what the cover shows. The men are lying on their backs on Fifth Avenue, right in front of the cathedral, making the basic Christian symbol the cross, to represent the suffering they were undergoing, which was compounded by their ejection from the church.
And it seems to be important to you to register such sacred spaces or change in sacred space, like St. John the Divine or the cathedral set against a street or a rock concert venue. I mean, spiritual experiences are taking place all over, mostly New York in this book.
Yes, and there's a whole episode in the book that involved John Paul II's largest tour of America in 1987. He went to, I think, a dozen cities, gave Mass, and celebrated Mass in football stadiums and parks. And so at a time when various rock and pop musicians were using religious imagery in their concerts, the most visible religious figure of all was drawing on popular imagery of the stadium crowd and making use of video, media, another aspect of public spectacle conveyed the power of the Catholic faith.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Paul Eli about his new book, The Last Supper: Art, Faith, Sex, and Controversy in the 1980s. Now, in one chapter called appropriately, What Are Roots?, you write about New Orleans, and I want you to read your description of the city, which I think is so lovely.
Well, thank you for that. And you know, on account of my first book, which has been set in New Orleans, I was feeling such a warm welcome to New Orleans half a dozen times then and subsequently, and so I'm drawing on that.
Well, we do it again. Come on back.
Well, I'd love to.
The Catholics from elsewhere, New Orleans was itself a kind of limbo, a place suspended outside of time, impervious to the forces of modern evasion and so-called renewal that were altering so much of the country. If I had to live in a city, I think I would prefer New Orleans to any other, where Southern and Tlapa can indicate that the devil's existence is steely recognized, Flannery O'Connor had told a friend after a trip there in 1862, putting forth an image of the city as bold and succinct as a tattoo. In a generation later, and now we're in the 80s, such a vision of New Orleans still prevailed among Catholics who had never been there. If you'd grown up Catholic in the suburb, where the immigrant church structure had been scattered by fight and city neighborhoods, the close-knit Catholic community was something out of legend, lately departed and already frothed up with nostalgia, seen mainly in the movies. But there was one place where the Catholic center was still holding, as South Philly, the North Bronx, and the north end of Boston changed. It was New Orleans. In the distant sense of the United States, New Orleans was still enchanted. There it was that different folks mixed it up together. Black and white, French-Canadian and Afro-Caribbean, girlfriend Pentecostal and voodoo. But somehow everybody was Catholic. There the culture was a hearty gumbo, people in touch with their roots, and the whiff of the illicit lurking around the old show places was what made them funky. There, devotion and desire mingled at ease, not held back puritanically from each other. Music was in the streets, people dancing, horns honking at a jazz funeral parade. There, Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, still meant something. And so just went, parishes holding a Friday justice so that the people could take pleasure in escaping from eating meat. There, in the mosque cemeteries in the low-lying neighborhoods and the saloons never closed, there, the ordinary was recognized as extraordinary. They could celebrate from this cruise to New Orleans with united in devotion. That's what those of us from the north part of New Orleans, often without really having a good knowledge of the place. And as a native, you have your own sense of it, to hit the what is this biblical in you?
The thing I like most is the notion of devotion and desire, because I think devotion is a unique, well, maybe not unique, but I think it's especially strong in New Orleans. Everybody has some kind of devotional practice. I was thinking the other day reading this book about how many people I know with home altars, that making a home altar becomes a preoccupation or a ritual, you know, when you move to a new house. And just,
this is so interesting. I had no idea.
And just the fact that we have a kind of liturgical year of our own, you know, with Mardi Gras and Jazz Fest, right, and those things, and rituals that are really adhered to. So that's what it brought home to me very vividly. And we are an intentional city now. We are here because people want to be here. And that's spiritual as well as economic or anything else. So
I'm so glad to hear you say it. One of the things I'm trying to do with this book is render different aspects of what I would call Christo-religious experience in which we can recognize ourselves. Instead of just saying left or right or conservative or liberal or progressive or traditionalist, that devotional character is a kind of human response that's pre-political.
Mm-hmm.
And the way devotion and desire fit together, I think if we think about that, a lot of us can understand our own lives a little better than the stigma that are typically forced on us. I'm really trying to unearth some of these patterns, bringing to the foreground.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are several New Orleans figures in this chronicle. And of course, one of the crises of faith in the 80s was the beginning of those Catholic Church abuse scandals, which really began with the journalism of New Orleans writer Jason Berry. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about that beginning, because you write about that in your book.
Well, that's right. And so Jason, he's expert in the Catholic Church and he's expert in the music of New Orleans. So
yeah, what a combo.
Significant impact on this book, because his account of New Orleans music and the role of religion that played in it is really vital. And then his account of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church was groundbreaking. And what's not well understood, I can't establish the direct causal line. At the moment when Sinead O'Connor co-opted the photograph of John Paul II in October 92, Jason Barry's book was just out, Lead Us Not in Temptation.
Mm-hmm.
It had also been a Primetime Live segment about clerical sexual abuse that summer. And the journalist Frank Bruni and another writer had brought out a book about sexual abuse. So around about 92, what had been kept secret or suppressed finally coming to light in a big way. And only in this small part to the work that Jason had done.
And I wonder if you talk a little bit about the Neville brothers, because they are so important in this book. And you capture them so wonderfully individually.
Well, the Neville brothers, I remember walking past the Lone Star Cafe, which was on Lower Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, wanting to go to the Neville brothers. And the place was so packed, there was no chance of getting in. Football, the Neville brothers had a large band in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple musicians, and they were playing in a nightclub in New York, and everybody seemed to like how crowded it was, but it wasn't convenient if you showed up late. I actually learned about Aaron Neville doing hymns and things with piano accompaniment in Brooklyn, and that was fascinating to me. But at the very time when he and brothers were playing their totally original blend of punk and New Orleans and soul, and spiritual, as a group, Aaron was also doing spirituals on his own. We just kind of followed that line, and it led to this, for me, extraordinary story of how the brothers got together, simply at the deathbed urging at their mother, who was pious Catholic, and decided in midlife to try to take the various addictions they'd been facing and get together and make the music they were capable of making as brothers. And so Aaron, in particular, this involved religion. Aaron had had difficulties with the law involving small amounts of drugs and one theft. And at a couple of occasions, he and his mother and his wife all back to the devotion to Saint Jude at the church in New Orleans where the devotion is.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he was able to resume the career of a musician, he attributed that to the intercession of Saint Jude and to the ground faith. So with a deepening of faith, each in recovery from addiction, and his band is suddenly having a lot of success, they start doing spiritual numbers in their set. And it's just a great encore to do Down by the Riverside and the others they did in that Nebley. There's a scene in the book in which they opened for the Grateful Dead
mm-hmm.
on New Year's Eve, and the Deadheads are kind of surprised and even shocked by the spiritual coming at 20 minutes to midnight. But if you watch the video, it's just perfect.
Well, and then they've gone from being a cult band to being a really big band suddenly, which is so wonderful.
And that was probably because of Bill Graham, who was Grateful Dead's manager. And in retrospect, all that music sticks together so well. The Dead
mm-hmm.
and the Neville Brothers and the jam bands and other bands had essentially a whole music and way of life that has been incubated at Jap that is now known all over the world.
And of course, you write about Bob Dylan's time here working with Daniel Lanois to make Oh Mercy.
And boy, I feel lucky writing that episode because Dylan's autobiography, Chronicles Volume 1, it's a deliberately scattered work. There's an episode about this, an episode about that, an episode about the other thing. But Dylan devotes maybe the longest and most detailed chapter to the making of Oh Mercy in New Orleans. So we have, in his own words, a record of what it was to be in the city, feel the spiritual undertow of New Orleans and the talent that it forced him to up his game as a musician, and then the good fortune of working with this producer who was himself in tune with New Orleans and in tune with what I call crypto-religious motifs, mm-hmm. been raised in a church in French Canada. So everything converged there. We had a rented place. Dylan would ride around on a motorcycle all day. He would explore cemeteries. He was listening to WWRV. And then they would get together and make Oh Mercy at night. And a whole new sound that Dylan developed over several subsequent records. And in some ways, a kind of equal set of records to the one from the gospel period came out of this session.
One of the places he rented was quite near my house, my old house. And We were on constant Bob watch during that period. And every now and then we'd see Daniel Lanois go down the street. But I remember it vividly, you know.
And that's a beautiful episode, too. Bono would begin it with Dylan out in Malibu. And he said, you know, you and Lanois would get on. And he just picked up the phone and called him right away. But Dylan said, I'll get there, but I got some stuff to do. But Dylan picked the moment to go to New Orleans at propitious, and it really was.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Paul Eli about his new book, The Last Supper, Art, Faith, Sex, and Controversy in the 1980s. Well, one of the things that I love about your writing is how generous you are with your own experience with the works. I wonder if you'd talk about which of the articles in this book, which of the items like music or film or art most invigorated your spiritual quest.
So I'm glad you feel the vigor of my response, because that's the whole point, really. I don't write in the first person for the most part, but the whole idea to carry some of that acceptable energy from the work, into my work, that you could feel the power of a Tom Waits song way down in the hole. That's the one everybody knows from The Wire. It was the preacher at a kind of Salvation Army style place. You're telling these guys that they got to get out from being down in the hole. That's his message. That's what he tells these down and out fellows. But you want to feel that in the book, and not just have it kind of related to you in a scholarly way. So I try to do that. And the excitement is actually doing that in the book, but also finding all the things that I don't know. I didn't know much about Leonard Cohen. And he became a central figure in the book.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know about the blend of Judaism, Christianity, and Buddhism. I didn't know how much of a constant it was in his work. I didn't know that songs we now consider canonical, like Hallelujah, with from the work-going record of his own whole career, his own record label wouldn't put it out.
And 88 notebooks with different verses. Oh, my God.
Way, then that he's kneeling in a devotional way, consecrating himself to the work, what's thought to be a deluxe hotel in Midtown. And that turns out that, you know, he's probably 500 feet away from the office in the Bill Building where Martin Scorsese could have making the Last Confession of Christ doing the editing. So that kind of discovery is what really gets me going.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, Leonard Cohen and Martin Scorsese and Madonna. We're all within blocks of each other in this moment. It becomes really exciting.
Well, this is just such a masterful book because it's so broad and deep. I'm really kind of gobsmacked by it. It made me want to go and reread everything. And I took notes. I remembered so many things. I remember the Pope being in New Orleans. I remembered being on Bob Watch. I have a signed copy of a Seshlov Milos book. I mean, it was really fun to go back to the 80s with you, I have to say.
So glad. And you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation that I do like to have both a lot of scope and a lot of detail. I think without the detail, you can't really feel how vivid the moment was. But the particular details you're mentioning, I really like a vindication of my whole approach. So thank you.
Well, I'm glad you were in New York to witness what you witnessed, too. I mean, we've been talking with Paul Eli about his terrific new book, The Last Supper, Art, Faith, Sex, and Controversy in the 1980s. Paul, thank you so much. This has been such a treat.
Oh, and a pleasure for me, too. Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Pam Abel presents Long Story Short, Why and How to Write and Market Short Fiction, Monday, July 14th at 3:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. free of charge, open to the public. Rachel Laurie and Jarrett Cohen discuss Black Capitalist, Tuesday, July 15th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Constance Adler reads from and discusses Sight Unseen, July 17th at 5:30 at Author Night at Ladder Library. Sue Strachan signs the Obituary Cocktail, Friday, July 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. To celebrate the book and the current exhibition, Hoa Tai, Flower Hands, at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, the museum hosts a conversation with author E.M. Trant, whose book Daughters of the New Year is this year's One Book, One New Orleans selection. Megan Holt, executive director of One Book, One New Orleans, and curator Yuyen Din also appear. This event takes place at Ogden Museum on Saturday, July 26th at 2, so start reading. The event is free and open to the community, but pre-register at the Ogden website. And mark your calendar and get tickets now for The Last Laugh, Wit, Wisdom, and 10 Years of the Walker Percy Weekend, coming up September 19th through 20th in St. Francisville. Headquartered at Conundrum Bookstore, the weekend includes panel discussions, a lunchtime book club, the traditional progressive front porch tour and bourbon tasting, the Taste of South Supper, as well as an appearance by musician Sonny Landreth. Organizers say this is likely the last time they will be producing this event, so if you love Walker Percy, this is the time to go. For more information, visit walkerpercyweekend.org. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.